You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400. Or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Good morning and welcome back to Radio Rehab. It's always good to be back and have good conversations with people that share about recovery and all the things we can do in our community to help people that have substance abuse disorders, co-occurring disorders, just things that prevent us from being the best that we can be. And today we have a fabulous guest, as usual, but this guy I have known throughout my career for 20 years, and he has been fighting the good fight to try to get people help with addictive disorders and co-occurring disorders. And he has the power and influence to do it because he is now the first deputy prosecutor for us in Warrick County, and he works for us in the drug court program in Warrick County. He worked with Judge Trockman in Judge Trockman's drug court program for over 5 years and has been to a lot of the national trainings and definitely is up on what's going on with people with addictive disorders and mental illness that get in criminal trouble and end up in prison. So this will be an interesting hour. I'm excited to introduce you to Dan Miller. Don't hesitate to call. He said we can call and ask him anything we want to ask him, and he'll answer from his experience and expertise the best that he can. He's got a lot of experience and a lot of expertise. Just a little note here. If you want to hear this on the internet, Ed Landers, the owner of WEOA, has made that possible for us now. So you can go to www.1400amweoa.com, and you can hear Dan Miller and Radio Rehab on the internet. And if you want to call here, 424-1400, call anytime. Don't worry about interrupting us. It'll go to Alice in the front, and then she'll come back to the radio show and let us know you're there with a question. So we want to be sure and answer your question. I think I've covered all the main announcements. I'm very excited to hear about Dan. I was getting to know him a little bit before the show. He's had an interesting, fascinating life and a lot of experience as a prosecutor. So welcome, Dan. Thank you so much for coming on a Saturday to Radio Rehab.
Well, thank you, Lisa, and good morning.
Good to have you. And you were telling me you were born and raised in Evansville. You are an Evansvillian.
I am an Evansville native. I was born at St. Mary's Hospital, and I lived practically all my life near the University of Evansville, but on the north side of the campus across Division Street. It's now separated by the Lloyd Expressway from the university.
Yeah.
I went to school in Evansville at St. Benedict's Grade School and then Memorial High School, where I graduated. I graduated in 1981, so I was in Evansville during and during my formative years was here in the 60s and 70s. My parents didn't have a lot of money, but they sure had a lot of spunk and grit. And I was the oldest of four kids and the oldest grandchild on both sides of the family.
Whoa.
And
the firstborn, huh? A male.
I was the firstborn and the blonde golden boy,
uh-oh,
as my younger siblings remind me from time to time. But our family life was very regimented and very achievement-oriented. I mean, we were into school was very important, church was important, and our activities were important. Dad was in business during my high school years. We owned a donut shop, and we all worked in that donut shop, both as a source of personal money, but more importantly, as family income. And I was an avid reader and graduated, I think they told me, third in my class from Memorial.
Jeez.
And, then
quite accomplished already in high school.
Right. I was a member of the 4-H clubs in Vandenberg County and was quite accomplished, attended Hugh O'Brien Leadership Conference, and I may have been the first person in Evansville, from Evansville, to attend that back in 1980
wow.
or there, somewhere in there. And then also I attended National 4-H Congress.
Jeez.
Was a state winner in health and safety in 4-H achievement. and then went on to college at DePaul University.
So you definitely were the golden boy.
Sort of.
Very achievement-oriented. Was that something you were focused on, or is it something you worked for, or was it in your personality?
I'm not sure what the origin of it was, but it's definitely in my personality. I'm somewhat of a type A personality.
Mm-hmm.
I was an avid reader and loved to lose myself in books when I was a child, and sometimes I'd get in trouble because I was off reading someplace when Mom wanted me to do something else. But at the same time, we were also very outdoors-oriented. A lot of what happened to me as a child are things that have stuck with me today. I love gardening. Well, in our family, we gardened in most cases because we needed to have you know, food cheaply, and sure, that was a way to do it. We gardened because Mom canned our vegetables, and we ate those,
wow,
through the winter, and started all over in the spring, and I learned to love it.
So you really learned young to work together in a community,
yes,
beginning with your family.
Yes.
So did you have any clue growing up of what was going on in other neighborhoods in Evansville and other homes, especially around drugs and alcohol?
Well, because I like to read and I became interested in reading the newspaper very early and in news shows about the age of 10, and that was in around 1972
wow,
elections.
Watergate.
That was actually before Watergate. I became interested in state and local and national affairs and politics and who was who, and I knew as much as anybody.
Wow. Just
what was
had
going
that
on
political in, flair young in life.
I guess, or at least an interest in other people. So I knew what was going on in the world. I mean, it was a time where of the Vietnam War, and
mm-hmm,
it was a time of a
lot of drugs,
of recession, drugs. I was aware of all those things.
Ever, you? Did any of that ever
not really
come into your circle?
Not really, and I told you before the show that I think my mother was the original grizzly mama.
She kept an eye on you.
She
huh?
had an eye on all of her children, and was I would say an aggressive mother in terms of keeping us all on the straight and narrow and keeping us focused on what she thought was important.
I wonder if you think that kind of parenting, and I've worked with kids for 20 years, and I always encourage parents, just watch, listen, read what they're writing, watch what they're doing. Do you think that kind of parenting, we've lost that along the road, that over-involvement?
I don't know that we've lost it. I think that in some sectors of our society we have lost it, if it ever existed, at all. Involvement, but not hovering.
Right. Not policing your kid, but
right,
guiding them,
and I think there's a fair amount of policing. I shared this sounds kids today, but I shared a bedroom with two brothers because we had three bedrooms. Mom and Dad got one. My sister, who was an only daughter, got the other, and the three boys.
Joan was the only girl.
Yes, she was.
Bless her heart.
Oh yes,
I knew why I liked her.
That's why she is the way she is. She had three mean brothers.
Oh God. She would come to Team Power and wake up at 4 in the morning and go take care of those horses.
That's right.
You all are hard workers, the Millers.
That's right.
Very much so. So drugs and alcohol just didn't interest you at all?
No. And, we had good role models. I mean, Mom and Dad never drank, probably because they couldn't afford it. They had all of us kids to feed, and they had to work hard for everything that they had. And we were a family that I think only one time while I was growing up did we ever have a new car.
No kidding.
Everything else was purchased used, and
there's some advantages to that.
I think now that we, in comparison to a lot of other people, we were wealthy.
Yeah, true.
Because we didn't have a lot of material things, but we had what we needed.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, I had excellent parents who were interested in every aspect of my life.
Well, and it sounds like you were willing to work for whatever you got.
Right.
So you have a strong work ethic, and that's obvious working with you. So what shaped you into becoming a lawyer? What made you, was it the love for politics and social justice? We got a call. Don't hold on and answer that question when we get back. Hello.
Yeah, I've been enjoying your program here briefly, and the only comment I want to make is parents are the role models in their homes. At least they're supposed to be. But I think one of the failures we have in the 21st century, we have a lot of parents that are doing other things other than being role models. And I know General Colin Powell once said, when you walk into a classroom, you can identify the disciplined students, and that's the type of discipline that they have at home. Hmm. On the other hand, you can walk into a classroom, you see students that are just talking or walking around, whatever. Again, that's the kind of home environment they have.
Yeah.
So it all goes back to parents being the first teachers. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and that's what Dan Miller was just demonstrating for us and his family. They were definitely available. And I think that, as the caller said, that does make a big difference. But I also have to say there's a lot of parents that economically just can't be available. I've met a lot of folks on this show, Dan, that have to work and have to work long hours just to keep a roof over their head, which is a dilemma for a lot of parents.
And I think that's right. And I think also the other thing that we need to realize is that I think at childhood stage, childhood and adolescence, mm-hmm. that's a very changeable time for mm-hmm. kids, and that's when kids find themselves. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite period of growing up, not for myself personally, but to watch them grow up, is the 7th and 8th grade, because that's when they find
really
stuff
is.
that
yes.
captures them and interests them, and they can focus on it.
I think you're right.
It's part of their psychology that they become enraptured with a subject or an mm-hmm. activity mm-hmm. at that age, and it's wonderful to watch, and it can be a positive thing even when mom and dad may be too busy to be involved in every aspect of their lives. They can still support them in that curiosity and in the values.
And as you said, those so impressionable years, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. Mm-hmm. We have another caller already.
Yes.
Hello, welcome to Radio Rehab.
Well, thank you. No, you made a comment. I'm the same caller about the working parents.
Yes.
And I realized that, you know, in some households, it takes both husband and wife to work. However, I have the one daughter, my wife and I work down through the years and everything, and when I hear parents use that excuse, to me that's inexcusable, because parents have to regulate their time mm-hmm. and take the time, whether they're working or not working. And when I hear them use this excuse, we both have to work to make ends meet, that doesn't escape the idea of you can't spend a certain amount of time with your children. But I hear this so often.
I do too, yeah. So you're saying it's a matter of priority.
That's correct. And we know husband and wives are working this day and time, but yet, you know, there comes a point in time where, like, our president, Barack Obama, says, you have to shut the television off.
Mm-hmm.
But if nobody's at the house to mm-hmm. tell the youngster to shut it off, then that's another problem.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it takes organization, you know.
Planning, yeah.
You know, if your home is not organized, they always say, once you leave your home, your workplace or your church is not going to be organized mm-hmm. either.
Wow.
And it all reverts back to the home.
To the home, yes.
But when I hear this idea of parents, you know, we both are working, we can't devote enough time. To me, that's inexcusable, because I've talked to enough principals, and they always tell me, even if it's like 15 minutes at night just to go over something,
mm-hmm.
but do parents really do that?
Mm-hmm.
And principals, they're pretty open. They want to see parents at the school, not when their son and daughters are in trouble. They want to see the parents participate
yes.
in their yeah. sons and daughters' activities. But unfortunately, some principals say, I only see Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so when their son or daughter is in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very unfortunate.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. So he's saying cut out the rationalizations, parents, and step up to the plate. As a prosecutor, gosh, do you see a lot of that, Dan, as a prosecutor, a lot of just kids running out there wild, nobody watching, nobody spending time with them? Or adults, too.
Well, I don't see a lot of kids because kids typically don't, they may be causing trouble in school, but or slacking in school, and that's not something that comes before a prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
The kids that I saw in Vanderburgh County,
in the drug court,
through my brief involvement with the juvenile court there, I really and truly felt sorry for, because so many of them, and I hate to say this, but so many of them had parents that I wish were also under the same strictures that the kids were,
yeah,
that we had placed the kids under. And I sometimes felt that we were fighting a losing battle, because I think some of the basics were in being adhered to. I mean,
mm-hmm,
basics like making sure the kid has breakfast before he or she goes to school.
Mm.
Okay. And I realize that maybe there are some families, in a fair amount of families in this town, who can't afford to give them breakfast, and that's why we have the free lunch program.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, teaching the kids to eat that breakfast and expect that breakfast, and giving them the energy to get through the morning,
mm-hmm,
when learning occurs and change can take place.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's that level of basic care that if they're not getting, why should they love themselves enough to be substance free or to follow the very basics of the law?
Yeah. Well, a lot of them have parents. What is it? One out of four kids in the schools is going home to a parent that probably has a substance abuse or mental health disorder.
And I don't know where that statistic comes from, but that's an alarming statistic if it's,
yeah,
true. I mean,
yeah, it's,
I mean, 1 in 10 would be too many. 1
yes.
in 20 would be too many. But 1 in 4 is disastrous,
yeah,
if that is a,
yes,
true statistic.
Yeah, yeah. I forget who told us that on here. Maybe Dr. Wooten through Youth First.
Mm-hmm.
I think 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10 people that start drinking and using drugs can become addicted.
Well, and that's the one, I mean, good things happened to me in my childhood, and that's what influenced me today. If I had started drinking,
oh,
at the age of 10 instead of becoming interested in politics and law, where
wow
would I be now?
Where do you think
one of the
be?
One of the hugest risk factors for addiction is the age at which you start using
onset,
substances.
Yes, yes. And now it's 10. That's even old.
Right. We see it 10 and
yeah
all the time.
When you and I got in this in 1985 with Parkside, it was 16. 15, 16 was the first use. Now it's really 11.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. So, yes, parenting. And it sounds like you had fabulous parenting.
I believe that I did, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know what, and both of us have seen people that had fabulous parenting that still started to drink and got in trouble with alcohol.
Sure, and, you know, it may be also that we know that there is a genetic component to,
right,
addiction. And
absolutely.
So it may not have been mom and dad, but grandpa or an uncle is an addict, and there is a genetic predisposition.
Yes.
Doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be acted upon, but it's certainly an explanation for why someone may have started despite their parenting.
If you have a parent or grandparent that had alcoholism or a substance disorder, you're 4 times more likely to develop one than somebody that doesn't have a parent or grandparent.
Right.
So genetics definitely is a strong factor. Don't go away, Radio Rehab. We've got Dan Miller, our prosecutor at our drug court program in Warwick County, as well as first deputy prosecutor for all of Warwick County. Keep calling. We'll be right back.
Okay, Luke, come on up and share your book report.
The Field Guide to the Benefits of Home Ownership. This book is about the American dream, family values, and good guys winning. It could use some more pictures.
Independent studies show that home ownership not only benefits families, it also creates jobs and helps build stronger communities. To find out how home ownership can benefit you, talk to an agent who is a realtor. And visit houselogic.com/buy and sell for more information. Every market's different. Call a realtor today. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Nothing stopping us from our power walks.
Not even our allergies, thanks to non-drowsy Claritin.
It gives me powerful relief from my worst symptoms.
Yeah, like itchy, watery eyes, sneezing, and runny nose. Oh, how about those great Claritin coupons?
What? How'd you find Claritin coupons?
I just looked in Sunday's newspaper.
Wow, that easy?
Easier than power walking.
Get the relief you want at a price you'll love. Look for money-saving coupons on non-drowsy Claritin in Sunday's newspaper. Live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
Ashley Furniture Home Store in Evansville's 14-piece package sale ends this weekend. Choose either a 14-piece living room or 14-piece bedroom package for only $12.99. That's a $495 savings. Hundreds of packages are available. Plus, get special 12-month no-interest financing. Ashley Furniture Home Store in Evansville's 14-piece living room and bedroom package sale going on now. Sleep better tonight. Every Sealy and Simmons mattress set on sale now. Hurry, it ends this weekend at Ashley Furniture Home Store, located on North Green River Road at Morgan Avenue in Evansville.
You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Warrick County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400, or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Good morning, everybody. We're back to Radio Rehab talking to Dan Miller, who is the first deputy prosecutor in Warrick County and has been involved in the problem-solving court movement for several years, beginning with Judge Trockman. So we're back talking to him. Don't hesitate to call 424-1400 if you have any questions about any judicial process or law or anything about Dan. He'd be glad to chip in and answer from the best of his expertise. So, Dan, you went off to DePaul, became a lawyer, and came back, and you've been a prosecutor your whole law career.
With the exception of the first year when I clerked for the Indiana Court of Appeals, I came and was hired in August of 1989 by Bob Pigman, who was the prosecutor. There was an election in November, and Bob Pigman did not run again. Stan Levko ran and was elected. And when he came on in January of 1990, he decided to keep a very green and inexperienced young prosecutor.
Maybe that was good.
Oh, I'm glad he did.
Yeah.
I'm glad he did, because I don't know that I necessarily deserved to be kept, and certainly would have been within his purview to hire someone else. But he kept me on, and I spent about 3 years in misdemeanor. And somewhere in the 1990s, I don't remember exactly the year, Jonathan Parkhurst became the director of the Drug Law Enforcement Program, and at some point, through some staff changes, staff wanting to change, or maybe someone left, I'm not exactly sure which, there was an opening in that program. He wanted me to come aboard, I wanted to come aboard, and Stan okayed it, and I've been with the Drug Enforcement Program pretty much ever since.
Your whole career?
For approximately 14 or 15 years.
So, is that an interesting place for a prosecutor to be, in the drug and alcohol end of the justice world, or were you just curious about drug enforcement?
I don't know exactly why I was curious about it, but I
you knew it was a big society problem, I'm sure.
It was a big problem. There was a lot of work involved, and certainly a lot of cases involved. I certainly had some interesting cases. I think in anyone's memory in Vandenberg County, I prosecuted the first mushroom-growing case in Vandenberg County, and it ultimately got appealed and was and is in the record books. And actually, there is a website devoted to psychedelic drug use in which my case from Vandenberg County is mentioned as you know, there's a link to it.
No kidding. When was that?
This was. And probably around 1995 or 1996.
Well, that was right in the middle of the crack cocaine days, too. I mean, crack's still around, but
right.
It was really coming in then.
And at that point, crack cocaine was the most prevalent drug, but we had this crazy fella who basically had his girlfriend over, gave her some mushrooms. She had a huge reaction, and the investigation started from there. We hauled all of his equipment out of his apartment, and John Parkhurst was my boss at the time, and he said, you know about growing stuff, because I'd been in 4-H, and he said, you figure out how to prosecute this case. And so I did, and we got a conviction. That was kind of fun to do something out of the ordinary like that.
Yeah.
And I probably, right now in the local area, I'm probably the most knowledgeable one about psychedelic mushrooms.
You're most knowledgeable about a lot of things. So you just stayed then in the drug enforcement end of prosecution and got involved in coalitions in the community like the Substance Abuse Council. And
yes.
I remember we worked with you at the Mulberry Center a lot with I guess the Substance Abuse Council. Maybe that was the link.
Yeah, the link was Substance Abuse Council.
And
through
Team
that,
Power.
Right, and through that, I know that I served on committees outside of the Substance Abuse Council because of my involvement both with Substance Abuse Council, and of course, I was president of it for 2 years as well.
Yes. Yeah.
And then as a deputy prosecutor, being asked to serve on various advisory committees and things like that.
So, as a prosecutor from that 1990 to 2011, what would you say, just looking back over the past couple decades, has really changed in our communities around drug and alcohol usage, attitudes?
Well, what has really changed was methamphetamine. Methamphetamine was on the radar when I started. Chris Lynn and Jonathan Parkhurst, when they were in the drug law enforcement program, prosecuted methamphetamine cases.
Crank, it was called, wasn't it?
It was crank, and it was imported. It was imported. They were bringing it in from somewhere and distributing
Canada.
It. And they had a an overarching conspiracy indictment and basically shut it down, or so we thought. Also, something that was happening simultaneously at that time, and I somewhere in all my stuff, I've still got this report. Someone in the state of Indiana commissioned a report called the Rural Indiana Drug Report, and basically the findings of that report were that in that percentage wise, there was more substance abuse in rural Indiana counties than in places like Marion County or in Evansville or. And percentage-wise, not that there weren't
per capita,
not that there weren't big problems in those areas, but the problem was big in those areas because there were more people in those areas. And I think we didn't pay very much attention to that because we thought, oh well, it's just alcohol and it's not a big deal. And so what if the rural Indiana people abuse alcohol? There's nothing else for them to do. But I think that report recognized that that was fertile ground for what happened to us in the late 90s and early 21st century, and that was the explosion of methamphetamine through the homemade methamphetamine labs, where somebody who practically doesn't even know how to read can make methamphetamine in the backyard with all the detrimental after effects of it, not only the addiction and the distribution, but the chemical waste. And so I very early about that time became somebody who knew as much about making methamphetamine as anybody because I had to present it to a jury, and I never thought in my wildest dreams when I was a kid and I was growing up in Evansville and giving demonstrations on things like cardiopulmonary resuscitation that one day I would be in front of juries essentially giving a demonstration on how to make methamphetamine.
Jeez.
With all the props and photographs and all the things that the police gathered to demonstrate how that was done.
So that was a turning point in the career.
And it's been a turning point in Indiana. And all the things that the legislature is talking about right now, the huge spike in prison populations, I would say better than 50% of that is due to methamphetamine by itself.
Not crack cocaine?
Not necessarily crack cocaine. I mean, you know, crack cocaine is a problem, but in my last year of prosecution in Vandenberg County, my prescription drug abuse cases, my prescription drug possession and acquiring cases, the number of those cases was higher than my cocaine cases.
Prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, we're seeing the opiate explosion now, too.
Right.
So as a prosecutor, would you say methamphetamine, crack cocaine, the stimulant, that those are the most deadly to our society?
Yes, they are the most deadly. And although I think if you see overdoses, you see it with the prescription drugs.
True.
And we don't catch all the prescription drugs because they're harder to catch because they're quote-unquote legal.
Yeah.
And there is a whole lot more work involved in determining that somebody is guilty of an offense with that because we have to do the paperwork trail.
Yes.
And police officers don't like paperwork.
No.
They like going out in the field and
doing their thing.
Legally busting down doors and collecting evidence and that sort of thing. And following a paper trail is tedious work for police.
So for controlled substances, you got to get doctor reports, pharmaceutical.
Right.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. So in your opinion, as a prosecutor. Well, let me ask you this. Why don't they check to see if people are impaired driving under the influence of methamphetamine or marijuana like they do if they're driving impaired under the influence of alcohol?
Well, they do that somewhat. They have trained certain police officers, and there's not enough of them at this point, but they've trained certain police officers to determine, and they're called drug recognition experts, to determine based upon eye responses and other physical manifestations that someone is driving impaired under the influence of some controlled substance.
Mm-hmm.
As a legal matter, I have to figure out what that controlled substance is in order to present it to a jury. And so it's more time-consuming. Alcohol is so much more recognizable
right away
because of odor and the its presence on the breath, which can be measured and transferred, and that measurement can be converted accurately into a percentage of blood alcohol content.
Mm-hmm.
That's not easy or quick with any other controlled substance, including marijuana. And so, yes, there is some technology and training that is starting to go in that direction, but still we have a long way to go in order to be able to easily determine that someone is under the influence of a drug while operating a motor vehicle.
Yeah, they've got the oral swabs that you can tell if they've used marijuana within 24 hours, but I guess that's a legal issue to have them do that.
Right.
You have to show beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right, and so that's almost always going to involve with a blood test. And it may be that somewhere down the road the technology will be such that it'll pass our legal requirements of being an accurate and reliable test for purposes of presenting it to a jury. But it's like even now I can go out with a portable breath tester and determine that you've consumed sometime previous to being tested alcohol, but it will not accurately determine what's in your blood. Mm-hmm. You have to use the Data Master, one of those devices that has been scientifically proven to accurately measure in order to present that in court and get a conviction in court, to even actually get the evidence in. The portable breath test is not evidence in a drunk driving case. It's not reliable enough.
The blood alcohol?
The portable breath tester.
That they do on the side of the road?
Right.
So a defense attorney could fight that.
Well, and they will fight that because it's not reliable. It is a fairly good indication when, if you're...
0.25.
It's a good indication for this. If you're underage and you've just consumed alcohol, it's a good indication that you have consumed alcohol underage.
Yes, so now, for underage, it's a slam dunk.
Yeah, but
it's illegal.
But for the drunk driving offense where you have to be over 0.08 to be
I remember when it was 0.10.
Yes, and they did some studies and found that, you know,
you're impaired at 08.
Yeah, you're impaired, too impaired at 08, and you're actually somewhat impaired at 0.05.
So, you know, going into the drug court and you moving into that, do you see that as a good opportunity for social justice and social work to work together as long as justice comes first?
I see it as a good as a prosecutor. I see it as a good opportunity, and not all prosecutors across the state agree with me on this. But I see it, and I'm not sure that when I first started that I necessarily agreed with it. But I see it as a good opportunity because of the painstaking research that has gone into it, and we are still learning, and we're dealing with human subjects, and every human being is different somewhat, and we don't have a good test control group. You know, we just can't put somebody and say, okay, you can use all the drugs you want and we'll see what happens to you and so forth. So, you know, we don't have a good control group. So we're still...
I know some that would volunteer for that.
Perhaps.
You probably do too.
But, you know, we don't have a good control group and so the we're still somewhat in our infancy in terms of research. But the research that we have had, the evidence-based treatment programs that are showing us how to get results that are are at least more acceptable than what they were in terms of long-term rehabilitation, long-term sobriety for people who were 5 years ago classified as hopeless addicts.
Yes.
That is a good opportunity. That is a good opportunity for us. And as from a prosecutorial standpoint, anything that I can do to poke the drug dealers in the eye and take away their profits is something worth investing in. Mm-hmm. As a prosecutor, I go after the supply.
Mm.
But, you know, if I close down Wendy's, there's still McDonald's.
Yeah,
as long as people still want hamburgers. So if we can somehow get at it from the demand side as well by turning people away from drugs and alcohol and doing adequate prevention, I think that's money well spent as well.
Well, I know in our drug court, we don't take dealers. Now, 3 grams if it's for their own use, and it seems that always ends up on their record, manufacturing meth, even if it was under 3 grams.
Right.
Why is that?
The legislature has classified manufacturing methamphetamine as a dealing offense, and in reality, most manufacturers make it for themselves and for others.
Mm-hmm. Not for profit.
The problem with methamphetamine is that it's so deadly and so so debilitating that you just aren't going to make any money out, because everything that you have goes into the addiction. That's been, for the most part, our experience. Now, the folks that import crystal meth from Mexico, that's a profit thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So
crank.
And here's the thing. We haven't seen a lot of, or at least in Vandenberg County last year, we weren't seeing a lot of crystal meth because of the prevalence of the one-pot labs.
Are in people's homes, cars, parks.
Yeah, the ones that explode and kill people and do damage to apartment buildings and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh, that is scary.
Mm-hmm.
So since drug court, and that's what you're a part of, really doesn't, in its target population, look for the big dealers, most of the folks that end up in problem-solving courts are the little guys.
Right.
That need rehabilitated or might respond to rehabilitation.
Sure.
So do you know up front in the courtroom when you're in there as a prosecutor which ones in that courtroom that are up in front of you would qualify to be that kind of a drug addict as opposed to which ones are more criminal-minded?
In Wark County, I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to rely on the police detectives to tell me how involved someone is. In Vandenberg County, though, I got pretty good at it, yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
I could tell, you know, by reading the reports what they found, and you know, also by talking to police officers and learning about their investigations. And you have to realize that drug prosecutors are trained to be in on the investigation before an arrest is made. So a lot of times I was writing the search warrants and
you know what's coming,
right?
Wow. So you know they're guilty before a judge even or a jury deems them guilty.
I never filed a charge on somebody I didn't think was guilty, now proving it is sometimes else sometimes something else, and you know, so I mean, I've filed cases that I took to trial and lost. It's not because I didn't think they were guilty. It's just the jury found some defect in my evidence.
Mm.
But
that's pressure.
Oh yeah,
for both sides. So the drug court has been a welcomed part of the system where you're coming from, probably.
Yes, it wasn't. I didn't understand it at first, but yes. And the reason it is because it's not a bunch of do-gooders trying to help the poor drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
It is based upon evidence. Somebody has gone in and studied what has worked.
What's worked,
and,
right.
And the other thing about drug court that I really like, and it's always something that we need to strive to improve in drug court, is that it is a total program. You just don't go in and try to fix it's not like a car. You know, if the battery goes down, you know you replace the battery and the car runs fine. You have to work on the entire system of someone's life, and that a lot of times involves job training
financial planning. Oh, yeah. Like an octopus.
Family counseling.
Yes.
You know, relationship
yes.
building, that sort of thing. Reintegrating them into a society that is positive rather than,
that's true.
If in Vandenberg County we have the churches embracing offenders. Mm-hmm. A lot of times if those folks are involved, they get the offender involved in a community that is progressive and life-affirming rather than one that is constantly
beating them down.
Self-aggrandizing and drug-seeking.
Wow. You've done a lot of research, Dan. No doubt about it. You're an encyclopedia of knowledge about this. Don't go away, Radio Rehab. We're going to come back and finish up talking to Dan Miller. Don't hesitate to call or text if you have any questions. We'll be right back.
African Americans Yesterday and Today, sponsored by Diversity Supply Company, Incorporated. Jerome Stewart, President.
And now, a moment in Black history.
Paul Robeson. Paul was the first Black actor to play Othello on the American stage. A Phi Beta Kappa student at Rutgers, he attained the highest scholastic standing. He can speak all the modern European languages and Russian. He also reads 20 other languages, including Chinese. A renowned concert singer, he received a law degree from Columbia. He was a fighter for Negro rights during his early career.
Play big jackpot games from the Hoosier Lottery. Current estimated jackpot for Powerball with Power Play is $184 million. Must be 18 or older to play. Please play responsibly. WEOA, the most diverse radio station in the tri-state, is proud to announce two new exciting programs for our Hispanic friends in the community. Tune in every Saturday afternoon at 12:30 to the new 24/7 Dad's Hispanic program in Spanish, sponsored by the Juan Diego Latino Center. The half-hour show discusses life skills, parenting, and a host of other relevant topics. Conexion Thalia Radio Show. Thalia is a platinum-selling recording artist, internationally known, and nationally syndicated radio host. This popular two-hour weekly program comes to Evansville by way of WEOA every Sunday afternoon from 12 to 2 p.m. Thalia discusses music, fashion, and entertainment. See you this Sunday at noon for the Conexion Thalia Radio Show, sponsored by the Juan Diego Latino Center. Listen to the Doug Banks Show every weekday at 4:20 p.m. for your chance to win a $50 Fifth Third Bank gift card. Every daily winner will be entered in a drawing for $1,000 for themselves and $5,300 for a local charity of their choice from a list provided. The Fifth Third Bank $5,300 charity donation right here on 1400 AM WEOA.
This is my way to learn Spanish.
This is my way to learn French.
My way to learn Russian.
Italian.
Japanese.
My way.
My way.
Chinese.
My way to learn a foreign language.
The best way to learn a foreign language is your way. Rosetta Stone invites you to try absolutely free our latest solution, new version 4 Totali software. Developed around the way you think and the way you learn, the same way you learned your first language. In fact, it's been recognized as the fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed.
It's totally my way to learn Spanish.
No classrooms, no boring drills, no useless memorization. It's a learning program that works around you, not the other way around. And right now, you can try it absolutely, positively free with a free demo CD-ROM.
Free. That's definitely my way.
Try the new version 4 Totali for free by calling 1-800-335-1656. 1-800-335-1656. For your free demo, call 1-800-335-1656.
You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400, or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
On their turf.
Welcome back. Oh, sorry, I was talking to Dan Miller. There's so much to ask him as a prosecutor from the legal perspective of how we help people that have addictive disorders or co-occurring disorders. And we were talking at break about, you know, Dan is very much an advocate at the state and local level for the problem-solving court movement and has seen its successes in evidence-based outcomes. So I asked him a question we get a lot on Radio Rehab that, great, the criminal justice system and law enforcement have finally started to get trained and understand that people have addictions or mental health issues that drive their criminal behavior. Wonderful. Applaud the Judicial Center for that. However, when people get into these programs and relapse, where does the judicial center go then? Because once they relapse, it changes the nature of things, especially for a prosecutor who, and I was asking Dan, what does happen at relapse? Do they have to get revoked then? Or how do you, Dan, as a prosecutor, and then how do you just philosophically feel about that when people get in these programs but then relapse or struggle to succeed in them?
Well, if someone is in a program and they relapse, typically we catch them. The most frequent way we catch them is through drug testing. Mm-hmm. And so it's reported from the case manager or the probation officer that someone has relapsed. And this was one of the toughest things that I had to get my head around when we first started drug court in Vandenberg County, was the idea, and it was being advertised by the media, well, they're not going to care if somebody uses drugs while on the program because it's actually part of the addiction process. And so the you're making a face, and, yeah. And the way it was reported just really made my skin crawl as a prosecutor, because, you know, it's evidence that somebody has at least been in the possession of a drug at some point and has committed a crime. Now, it's not necessarily something I can prosecute because I don't have any evidence, but it's certainly
the drug
evidence.
Screen.
Drug screen is at least some evidence that a crime is taking place. And so it was difficult for me to wrap my head around the addiction model, that we should expect that as recovery progresses that there might be setbacks, mm-hmm. known as relapses. And the analogy that was made to me is one that's familiar because I have a family history of it, and that is diabetes. Mm. You know, diabetics have relapses all the time, and as long as it doesn't kill them, it's something that's fixable and manageable. Mm-hmm. And sometimes diabetics have relapses through no fault of their own because of, you know, they run a fever or something and it throws the whole system off and the blood sugar gets high or whatever. Diabetes is a chronic thing. You have to limit your intake of
carbohydrates,
change your lifestyle and that sort of thing. And I'm familiar with that with members of my family who are diabetics. So It was difficult for me at first, though, to get around the whole relapse thing. Now, as a prosecutor, I am required to actually take an oath to uphold the law. Mm. And so the difficult and disappointing thing is that when we've got somebody who's been in drug court and we have set them free because they have committed or performed all the requirements satisfactorily, and we've graduated them, or however that you want to, and
or put
then,
them up in another phase.
And so their criminal case that put them in drug court is over. We've taken care of that part, and then they commit another crime. Mm. And as a prosecutor, I am required to prosecute that crime if I've got the evidence to do so, and I will do so. I have to do that.
Yes.
And it's can be heartbreaking. On the other hand, it can be also maddening, because if it's a drug crime, a drug dealing crime, as it has been in the past, that's when the wrath of Dan comes down. And,
yeah, the wrath of the prosecutor comes out.
And you are going to go to prison if you're... You know, if you have been through the drug court program and gotten that break and you deal again, I'm sorry, but, you know, there's only so much I can do for you.
The dealing part is, I'm with you there. That's a whole different thing.
The drug possession. Which
the relapse
is,
of using again.
And the relapse after using again, then we're faced with the problem of...
honesty and all that.
But also the very practical problem is I've already expended drug court resources on you. Hmm. And, you know, you're not going to get back in drug court after that, even though that might be part of it. Now, one of the things that has happened is that some of our folks who have relapsed have realized what the problem is, and either before they get arrested, mm-hmm. they've gone to the drug court case manager that they had or something, and I know that our case managers are Debbie Mowbray in Vandenberg County. She will immediately use what influence resources she has to get them back into treatment before they get arrested. So just because somebody's relapsed doesn't mean that the whole system shuts down. As a prosecutor, I've got a duty. Yeah. And if the police arrest you for possession, I'm going to prosecute it if the police have provided me with the evidence to do so.
Right.
What happens then, you know, maybe up to the judge. Maybe we have certain minimum non-suspendable sentences under the law, that certain sentences, the minimum has to be executed in some way. You know, that's going to be a problem for us, but it's not necessarily the end of the world. And if they've been through a successfully been through a drug court program, they have the tools to get back on the wagon and back into sobriety.
And Judge Meyer always invites them to tell him if they're struggling, or tell any of us if they're struggling before, not after, even if we have a positive drug screen, if they're honest about it. That goes a long way, I think, with you and the judge, if they're honest about it. It's when they deliberately continue deceiving and being dishonest. But I think they're afraid to come to us with the truth sometimes if they're back in relapse. But that's no excuse. They need to...
Well, it's sort of like... You know, telling mom you screwed up.
Yeah,
you don't want to disappoint mom.
No, that's right. It's hard to go to the boss with bad news.
Yeah.
So, Dan, as a prosecutor, and we are so excited to have you in Warrick County. I have to tell you, Judge Meyer, I know Joanne Krantz, our team at Drug Court are very excited to have you, and I know Judge Trockman was very upset to lose you, but what would you like to see in maybe the near future, the movement of the problem-solving court? Do you like it to stay just the way it is, or there? If you had a wish list, what would that be?
Well, I guess the wish list would be adequate funding.
For sure.
So that we know that we have a future, and I'm not exactly sure how to accomplish that, and I'm not exactly sure who should be responsible for it. Should it be something that's locally funded because it benefits us locally, or should it be something that's state funded? Mm. I think some of the trouble that we're in right now is that everybody is touting it as a money-saving thing, and maybe it is saving the Department of Corrections money. If we are able to deal with someone and not send to the Department of Corrections, maybe that saves taxpayer money on the state of Indiana side. But at the local level, we're still dealing with a process that is expensive, and it's difficult to say that it's saving the community money, at least in the short term. I think in the long term, maybe, and certainly if we are able to develop the technology and the research to put in programs like Matrix and other substance abuse programs, and develop those programs so that we are able to improve the odds of rehabilitation. Mm. In the long run, I think it's going to be worth it. We just have to kind of be patient. At the same time, I would also wish that they not, skimp on law enforcement, because I think for the majority of people, the heavy boot of somebody in their backside is what motivates them
to
get into treatment.
And they all say that to the judge. Thank God that, somebody stopped the madness. So you're right, and we're lucky in Warrick County, and I think Vandenberg too. Our law enforcement are on board with the drug court model, and they believe in it. But they know that it's a target population of people that really could be served by it. It's not it can't help everybody.
And then the other thing that I would be on my wish list would be that there be community involvement in drug courts. And by this I mean that if somebody's in drug court and they come to you looking for a job, they have a criminal record. And if you've been convicted of embezzling, you probably should not be hired in a bank job. But if somebody comes, community involvement, hiring people who are in recovery, I think,
is key.
Involving them in your church, involving them in productive activities in the community, I think that's key as well. That would be on my wish list.
And I think that's beautiful, and that's a great way to end our hour together. You're reminding me it really is a spiritual thing. Let's involve these wounded people, not put a scarlet letter on them, and get them back involved in our community with open arms, in the workforce, in the religious, all through the community. I think that's a challenge for a community, but I've been very impressed with how Warrick County has opened their arms to most drug court participants and given them jobs. We still have a long way to go, because you're right, if they have a felony, that's a great gift for us to try to bring to our communities and to our folks that are in drug court. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
Will you come back? We've got much more to talk about, definitely.
The only thing is, as spring is starting to come into effect, I tend to be very busy.
I bet.
On the weekends.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now, Mr. Landers, I can go anywhere and tape at any time,
okay.
So that's kind of cool. So thank you for coming.
You're very welcome.
And Radio Rehab, thanks for your loyalty. Thank you for tuning in. And keep learning about this thing. We have a lot of work to do yet to take care of each other with substance abuse and mental health disorders. But a lot of caring, good people out there fighting the good fight. And Dan Miller's one of them. So thanks again. And between now and next Saturday, don't forget to do the next right thing.